So Ms. Schrader.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Kathleen Schrader, and I am the attorney representing Deborah Miller, the Chapter 13 trustee in the bankruptcy of Tim and Elizabeth Geisen. The issue before the Court is whether a 2007 amendment to the Indiana recording statutes, specifically having to do with the recording of a mortgage interest, is effective to reach back and change the legal impact of the recording of a mortgage that happened 6 years earlier. The presumption against the retroactive application of laws is deeply rooted in Indiana jurisprudence.
Before you get any further, I want to make sure that I'm correct that the impact of the question that you've presented, which is not to say that, you know, we won't decide it, but it's basically 1 year, right? Because if the bankruptcy had been filed prior to the 2007 amendment, we wouldn't have this question, as I understand it.
That is correct.
Post-2008, we also wouldn't have this question. So there's 1 year's worth of cases, and we have two others in this court?
That's correct. There are two other pending cases. Essentially, we're really talking about a gap, and that is anything that any bankruptcy petition that would have been filed between July 1, 2007 and July 1, 2008. So we are talking about a limited impact that these cases have. But yes, there are two current appeals before this court, slightly different facts, but they all have to do with defective acknowledgments and mortgage.
Okay, and so, you know, for you, I would say, I certainly can see that if we had had a hypothetical bankruptcy filed in 2006 or any time before July 1st, 2007, the strength of the bank, I'll just call them the bank because they keep changing names, the strength of the bank's interest would have been attenuated because of this defective acknowledgement. And so it wouldn't really have had the lien that it thought it had as against a trustee's BFP status. So in that sense, I can see that the legal situation has changed for the trustee since all of a sudden you're facing a stronger property interest because of the 2007 legislation applies to anything that was ever recorded in the history of time in Indiana. On the other hand, you know, I look at this mortgage and I think, who could have been fooled? You know, here we have, you know, it's on page 24 of the appendix, and on the very same page, here's this defective acknowledgement, and right above it are their names typed. They're not retyped in the same lines. Is there really any harm here?
This is actually one of the issues that the bankruptcy court had grappled with in the In re Baldwin case that was decided back in 1991. It was relied on by the bankruptcy court in Stubbs, which is the case that the courts that have considered this legal issue have pointed to, well, this is what sort of kicked the ball off rolling for the General Assembly to act. And the bankruptcy court did a nice job in Baldwin by going through and saying, well, yeah, this isn't really something that fools anybody, but that's not the law. And it did a nice job. It also relied on an Indiana Supreme Court case, the Sandy Ridge case, that had to do with the failure to name the preparer on a mortgage document. And it traced this case law back all the way to 1853. And in the 1853 case, it said, This is the well-established law in Indiana. So we're talking about a law that was well-established all the way back before the Civil War. So
when somebody's doing a search, do they actually see this whole page? And then my next question will be, what if the acknowledgement's on a different page and you don't actually see the names directly above?
Well, I don't think there's any – as you might imagine, that this case and the other cases had extraordinarily limited records, almost nothing. I don't know the answer to that question, but I would imagine that these documents were going to show up in a chain of title. And so regardless of whether the name was on a different page, it was still going to show up in a chain of title. But, you know,
Well, there's more risk of error if it's on a different page. If it's really all on the same page and you're fussing about whether it's typed at the top third or the middle third of the page, it sounds awfully picky. If it's on a different page, further risks of separation or what have you could happen.
Yeah, but I think you're right, and I think, Your Honor, that the word that you use is picky is probably right. But this is the law of secure transaction, and it is very harsh if you don't do exactly what you're supposed to do. And you know, one of the complaints that was made is that, well, this is a very harsh result for LaSalle or its predecessor in interest. But again, that is exactly what the court pointed out in the Baldwin case. Yes, it is a very tough result for these banks, but it's not like they can't avoid that. And
it's obviously be easy to avoid it. I don't understand why they didn't have these things notarized properly when they filed it. But on the other hand, why would a bona fide purchaser for value not back away when they saw that this would be a lien that would show up under any title strip?
Yes, and again, I would agree. This is probably going to show up on a chain of title, but again, under Indiana law, under the Picky law of property rights, where we are going to hold people to absolute compliance with the laws, at least up until the time of the 2007 amendment. Yes, maybe you can.
You have to rely very heavily on your idea that this is retroactive, though, and I'm not sure that that's correct.
I would agree. I would agree. If the 2007 amendment does cover every mortgage, regardless of when it was recorded, then it is game over for the trustee. This mortgage was effective. But as I opened, the law in Indiana is very, very clear. And it says we are going to require clear statements of legislative intent. It has to be unambiguous. It has to be unequivocal. The U.S. Supreme Court, when it was discussing the Landsgraf case, said the interpretive framework, and it's not unique to Indiana. Certainly the federal system works the same way, and I would imagine many other states. They have this predictable background against which we are going to look at enactments of a Congress or a General Assembly. And the General Assembly knows this. It knows that if it wants a law to reach back to some act that occurred prior to the effective date, it's going to either have to say it or the circumstances are going to have to be mighty, mighty clear.
Well, and I guess what I mean, among these three cases, we have different concepts of retroactivity. So from the point of view of the trustee in this case, the law had already changed by the time the trustee picks up the game and takes a look to see what things might be avoided and what things can't. I think that's what Chief Judge Hamilton, now our colleague, Judge Hamilton, said in his decision. On the other hand, I think you're right that there's one less formality, or actually a couple of less formalities, but from this case's standpoint, one less formality that's necessary for the mortgage to be something that cannot be avoided in bankruptcy now, and it reaches back to a time when that couldn't have happened. So the law has changed in that respect for the old mortgages.
Well, I would admit that the 2007 law amendment did change the law, but I
made a mortgage today unavoidable that would have been avoidable before that change.
That's correct. If I had a home mortgage and it was recorded today and there was a problem with the acknowledgement, it would not make a difference. But I think the problem with all due deference to Judge Hamilton and to LaSalle's argument, I think that point really begs the question, because LaSalle argues that the time the trustee's rights as a bona fide purchaser arose, at the time of the filing of the bankruptcy petition, the trustee knew that this mortgage was good. And, you know, our argument is no. The trustee didn't know that the mortgage was good. We've had six courts issue decisions on this case.
Whether the mortgage is good is a question of state law.
Absolutely. Whether the mortgage is good is a question of state law, and it has to do with whether that 2007 amendment is going to reach back and control the recording of a 2001 mortgage. LaSalle makes the argument that it's not being applied retroactively in this case, because what simply changed is that as of the effective date of the 2007 amendment, the bona fide purchaser rights were cut off. But I think that's inconsistent with the clear language of the statute that talks about making the change and reaching back as of the date of the filing. So what it's going to do is create those rights all the way back to the date of the filing, which in this case was May of 2001. So I think the way that the statute is written, it's very hard, I think, to make that argument that this is not changing the legal consequence of a past act. And I think the U.S. Supreme Court...
Well, is the relevant act the rights of the BFP, or is it the... Is it the right of the mortgagor in recording?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
I say, what are you talking about is retroactive? You're saying it's retroactive as far as the recording of the mortgage is concerned, but I'm saying it doesn't change the rights of the BFP retroactively, does it?
Well, what the law says is that it is going to provide constructive notice from the date of filing forward. And I believe the way that is written, I don't think you can square that with the interpretation that it simply changed as of the effective date. And so I believe, I mean, if you look at the language that this court employs in the Estate of Moreland case, the question has to do with will it attach a new legal consequence to the prior act. In 2001, when Allied records that mortgage, it is simply not good as against any bona fide purchaser, and the argument now is because of the 2007 amendment, it is good. And I think that fits squarely within this court's construct of is it attaching new legal consequences to a prior act?
No, but it only affects future BFPs, that's my point.
It would affect any hypothetical bona fide purchaser, yes. And in this case, it arose under the filing of the bankruptcy petition.
Well, what seems unusual to me is you've got three district judges going one way, two from the Northern District, one from the Southern District, and the bankruptcy judge is going another way. And if I recall, when in Wisconsin, maybe we do things better in Wisconsin than they
Wisconsin.
Do in Indiana, but when we had these kind of disputes, we'd work it out within the court, and the bankruptcy court being a part of the district court. So you'd get one decision, and the other bankruptcy judges then would be bound by the decision made first by the district judge.
Well,
that's kind of unusual here. That
I agree. I've never seen anything like this myself. Judge Dees was the first decision to issue. Judge Klingenberger relied in part on that, went a bit of another way. He looked at whether this was a remedial statute. And you know, our argument on that is in the most recent Indiana Supreme Court decision on remedial statutes is even in a remedial statute, retroactive application is the exception and not the rule and requires. That's the State versus Pelley case. But the interesting thing about the six decisions is we've made the argument that actually four of these decisions find this language to be ambiguous as to the scope. Judge Hamilton ruled a different way, but still said reasonable judges, reasonable lawyers can disagree as to the scope of that amendment.
Well, that's obvious that reasonable judges can disagree because three bankruptcy judges said one thing and three district judges said something else.
Right, and in that case, this is not like baseball where the tie goes to the runner. You can't, it's not a preponderance of the evidence. We're looking at something more like beyond a reasonable doubt, did the General Assembly intend the scope of this amendment to go back to cover mortgages that were recorded prior to the effective date? And when, you know, sort of bottom line, when you have six different judges disagreeing about this, I don't think you can reach the conclusion that the General Assembly absolutely intended for this to have retroactive reach. If there's no more questions,
I want to save a little bit. That's fine. Mr. Gallagher?
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Mark Gallagher. With me is Craig Doyle. We represent LaSalle Bank. Counsel for the trustee acknowledged, I think I heard her acknowledge in her argument that really, to win this appeal, she's going to have to rely on the rule against retroactive application of statutes, as she conceives it. And I really think that's where the trustee is in this case. As I reflect on the case law and preparing for the argument, I'd like to sort of parse out a couple of different ideas about the rule against retroactivity. As I consider the case law and as counsel argues the case law there, I think there are two principles at play. First, rule number one, a statute is going to speak as of the date of its enactment. If a statute has an effective date, well, it isn't effective in some sense as to transactions before that date.
So you would agree that the presumption is that when legislatures act, it's prospectively.
Yes, as a broad general rule, absolutely, Your Honor. But as Justice...
And particularly when it comes to property rights.
I would say very broadly as to almost any sort of statute.
But property and contract rights, I mean, indeed, there's a constitutional provision against impairment of the validity of contracts.
Absolutely. Here's the point I want to place in the court's mind, though, and Justice Scalia talked about this in his concurring opinion in the Landgraf case. It's one thing to say that a statute will generally operate prospectively, but that rule's not violated when the legislature passes a statute today, effective prospectively, that changes the effect going forward of events or transactions in the past.
Well, that's where we need to get more specific than that, because, I mean, it seems to me this is just all about what the Indiana legislature has done. No one is arguing that the 2008 legislation didn't do exactly what the bank lobby wanted it to do, which is to say, you know, make all of these technical defects of no moment. And no one is saying that the law was different before 2007, and so what we've seen is a shift of power from mortgagors to mortgagees based on what's going on. But that shift in power has been accomplished by changing the package of rights that goes along with a mortgage. And that's what concerns me, actually, because, of course, bankruptcy law looks to state law to see what packages of rights debtors have. In that sense, you know, maybe bankruptcy law goes too far sometimes, maybe it doesn't, but it is what it is, and the trustee in the position of bona fide purchaser either can or cannot avoid a lien depending on what that package of rights is. And the legislature here in 2008 says, yeah, we really mean to change it. We're going to change this forever. Fine. We aren't seeing this argument in post-2008 cases. So we have this odd year in which one of two things happened. I know your view is that, oh, you know, why would they have changed their mind? My view is, you know, the bank got, you know, half a loaf in 2007, and they said, hooray, you know, let's go back and lobby for a little bit more, and they get the rest of it in 2008. Happens all the time in legislatures. So I don't find that too stunning.
There are several things implicit in your remarks. I'd like to respond to several things that you said. First of all, this really isn't an issue, in my view, of the tension of, rights or powers of the mortgage lender versus the borrower.
But it is. That's the only thing that the law is doing. It's changing how strong a package of rights the lender acquires and relieving the lender of strict compliance with one particular, well, actually three, but anyway, certain rules.
Well, let me explain myself. None of these actions is being brought. Excuse me. None of these avoidance actions is being brought by the debtor. In fact, the debtor will never have.
No, they're brought by the trustees in the position of BFP.
Forgive me. Again, in a typical Chapter 7 bankruptcy, a debtor will file his or her bankruptcy case, will almost invariably hope to continue living in his or her house.
Well, this is a 13, yeah, but right.
Uh-huh. In fact, the Geissens can hope to continue.
They're not going to live in their house either way, as I look at this record. If you lose, you're a general creditor, and the value of the house gets spread out among the rest of the general creditors. If you win, it's yours.
Let me elaborate, Your Honor. In a typical Chapter 13 case, what a debtor has at least the opportunity to do is cure delinquencies in his missed payments to the lender. It's one of the big reasons why debtors file Chapter 13. Here's what I'm driving at, Your Honor.
But I'm just saying that the record in this case suggests that that's not the case here, because the statement appears a couple of times in the briefs and in the judge's decisions that if the trustee can avoid this lien, then it goes in for the general creditors.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So my point there is that so the question is, who is worse off, if you will, when this new statute is passed? And I want to say, well, it's not the debtor. The debtor doesn't really benefit from having the debtor's house sold out from under him or her and have his money taken and distributed to credit card companies instead of his mortgage lender. The debtor doesn't care. The debtor hopes to continue to make payments. Most bankrupt debtors' only hope of keep staying in their home is to make a bargain with the bank to continue their monthly payments and stay in the house. These avoidance actions makes that impossible. So that's all I'm driving at, Your Honor.
Right. And so, okay, if you want to say that this case is about whether banks win out over credit card companies, of course, banks are credit card companies, too. But
yes, Your Honor.
Sure. But in the final analysis, there's a shift in power that's happened.
Yeah, and that was the only point I was trying to make, Your Honor. And the second thing that you said, and you're absolutely right, is, well, retroactivity. I don't think that anything we're doing, my argument, violates the rules against retroactivity. I think the relevant regulated event aimed at by the statute, to use the term you used, Your Honor, is the effect going forward of a recorded mortgage on later bona fide purchasers. And that effect lands only the day of the forward. But apart from retroactivity, yes, we still have to ask ourselves, well, read the statute. What does the legislature appear to
That's
have
all
meant?
This is about. What's that 2007 statute doing?
Well, and my presentation is pretty straightforward about that, Your Honor. I read the language of the statute.
This statute is abysmally written, actually. Okay. I think it was before 2007. I think it was during 2007. I think it still is. But in any event, there's nothing much we can do about that.
Well, I am glad I don't have to stand here and defend the drafting of the statute as opposed to its implications for my client.
You didn't do it, I'm sure, so I'm not going to hold you responsible.
But as difficult as it is.
The lobbyists are supposed to let the lawyers do the drafting.
yes, Your Honor. The key term in the statute is, and I have it in front of me, perhaps the court does as well, the new bit added by amendment is the subsection C, which says, in crucial part, if an instrument referred to in subsection A of this statute is recorded. Yeah, that's the big if. And the whole debate here is, well, does my client's mortgage fall
within
that definition?
I confess this reminds me of President Clinton. You know, what's the meaning of is?
Well, we have no choice but to actually decide what is in this case, do we then? It means one or the other. And,
exactly.
And we're stuck with it. So, counsel in her briefs, I don't think she had the opportunity to talk about it here from the podium, makes much of the reference to subsection A. She says, well, if it refers to subsection A, that somehow tells us that we're referring only to newly recorded mortgages. Subsection A is the bit that says if it's a mortgage, it must be recorded. The problem with her argument there is this, though. Subsection A and its predecessor was on the books well before my client recorded its mortgage. So in 2001, when my client came along, there was a statute that says your mortgage must be recorded. My client complied with that statute. It recorded its mortgage. Had a problem with its notary block, but it recorded it. So it seems to me inescapable that my client's mortgage falls within the description of this opening line of the new subsection. My client's mortgage is an instrument referred to in subsection A. My client's mortgage is recorded. That is to say, it's on file in the recorder's office. The bankruptcy judge and counsel for the trustee wanted to make the kind of linguistic argument that if you just take that opening phrase, is recorded, it's possible grammatically for that to mean, well, as a sort of a present passive verb. It is recorded by somebody, is recorded hereafter. But I don't think that that's a reasonable interpretation of the language, just reading the language. I think that that's such a fanciful, strained reading that just from the face of the statute, this court may not make that reading.
I think that's why both the bankruptcy judges and the district judges have been struggling with these background presumptions about retroactivity, because if someone had chosen a wordier version that had said at the time it is recorded, or, you know, we can imagine thousands of different wordings, we wouldn't be here because we'd have the commercial certainty that is always desirable. You know, instead, here we have these cryptic
Yes, Your Honor.
Words that maybe require us to go to these background presumptions.
To the extent that the language is cryptic, and I have to say, there are a lot of people that wish they'd written it differently now, I'm quite sure. But to the extent it's cryptic, and to the extent this court wants to ask, well, really, what did these legislatures have in mind? They must have meant something. What did they mean? I wasn't hoping for a laugh on that line. But they must have meant something. What did they mean? The best place to look is not the presumption against retroactivity. That's kind of a last-ditch resort to interpret a statute, especially for the reasons spelled out in my brief. If you're looking for something else to hang your hat on that helps you understand what must have been meant by the statute, I think the 2008 amendment really is persuasive.
I have trouble with that, though. I mean, in general, for legislative interpretation, if you get a later enactment, the possibilities of manipulation are endless. Legislative history alone is bad enough, and, you know, it's probably just as well Indiana doesn't use it. But taking something that happened a year later, look what happened between 2007 and 2008. The world's starting to come to an end, real estate mortgage-wise, by the middle of 2008. I mean, the legislature could have had all sorts of motivations. I'm just not sure that we can take much from that.
And I understand what you mean by that, Your Honor. What that leads me to is this. Well, how we perhaps ask ourselves, well, how probable is it, how plausible is it that in 2007, the legislature, having troubled to create the statute in the first place, the original amendment, and pass it, how probable is it that they would have thought it was worthwhile to give what you characterize as half a loaf? That is to say, pass a statute that at the time they really intended to fix only mortgages that began to be recorded after that time.
Do you happen to know what the rate of turnover of mortgages is? One of the district judges, I think, said, you know, why would they bother to do this since most mortgages last 15 to 30 years? But, of course, most mortgages don't last 15 to 30 years. We have a very mobile society. People move, people refinance, people change over. Do you know what the rate of change is? I don't.
I'd have to agree with you, though, that just because mortgages are on their face
nominally,
15 to 30 years, that's not how long they actually last.
This is a very small mortgage, too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tiny.
Wrote the number down just in case somebody asked me.
Less than $50,000.
Under $50,000, Your Honor. If this were not one of perhaps 20 such issues, I have, I think, five of these that I'm defending in one case or another, perhaps we wouldn't have been here. So
we have two more coming up after the three we've already got?
There are two with pending notices of appeal. I have two more that are still in the bankruptcy court with bankruptcy judges holding
fire. Are those
fire
all
to
the Sal Bank?
No,
or are
Your
you
Honor.
Just the attorney for different...
I just seem to get this kind of project. So
the 32-21-41 specialist.
I'm a helpless a problem with my mortgage specialist, I suppose you'd say. I think what I could add, but that really is the point I want to leave you with. And I think Judge Simon was right where he's coming from. Pretty clearly, at least to me, that
Judge Lee in this case. Anyway,
well, I was referring to the other decision where I think I see my time's up. May I finish my sentence quickly? I'll try to be quick about it. It looks as if the legislature wanted to change the law. It used to be they favored strict compliance with the recording statute. They decided we don't care about that anymore. We want to favor leaving mortgages in place. I mean, if that's really the fundamental judgment they were making with this statute, it seems implausible that they would have wanted to do that only prospectively. But that's for you to decide finally. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Ms. Schrader?
I have to quickly sort of take issue with the idea that the presumption against retroactivity is some last-ditch consideration that the court is going to look at. I think in the Landgraf case, as I mentioned in my opening statements, the Supreme Court is pretty clear that it's going to create that very definite framework. So legislatures are going to know how the courts are going to look at a particular statute, and certainly a couple of months ago when this court considered the case, Estate of Moreland, and said, well, the General Assembly has evident acumen, has demonstrated evident acumen. I'm not sure if you're now going to share that based on what Your Honor has described as an abysmally written statute, which I sort of must concede there.
But you had another argument from the language of a subsequent part of this statute where they actually do say, even in the 2007 version, that this applies to all time?
That's right. This statute is the chapter of the Indiana Property Code that has to do with the priority of recordings. And the statute that we're looking right now is Section 1. Section 2, the very next section in this chapter of the Property Code, says right up front, it's going to apply regardless of when a mortgage is recorded. I think there's some earlier cutoff, maybe from the 80s. But that's right there in the statute. And it goes back to, again, what this court has said in the State of Moreland, this demonstrated acumen. They know how to do it when they're going to do it. They didn't do it here. And in that respect, the court is just simply constrained to say, we can't apply it. So the gap is the gap.
Do you agree that the banks are easier for homeowners to deal with than general creditors?
That I couldn't quite speculate as to that. If there's no further questions, thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.